and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, was sentenced this afternoon to 36 months in a federal prison. He had earlier pleaded guilty to a number of felonies, what the judge called a smorgasbord of fraud. He apparently only partially cooperated with the Mueller investigation, but prosecutors told the judge that Cohen had been truthful. Next, Meng Wanzhou was arrested on December 1st at the request of the United States because her company, Huawei, allegedly is doing business with Iran, which is subject to U.S. sanctions. But she has now been released on bail by order of a judge in Canada. Then, lawmakers from Britain's Conservative Party called for a no-confidence vote today in a bid to oust Prime Minister Theresa May because of the Brexit deal she negotiated with the European Union. However, as of the time of this recording, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, a majority of Tory party members have said that they would support May. That's enough for her to win. But the future of her government is still in doubt. And then Turkish President Erdogan said today that his country would begin a new military offensive within days in northern Syria, quote, to clear the area of Kurdish rebels on both sides of the Euphrates River, unquote. Erdogan added that Turkey would specifically not target Americans in the area, but the move will almost certainly raise tensions with the United States. And finally, Israeli soldiers entered Ramallah yesterday, with low-level clashes breaking out only yards from the home of Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The soldiers seized security footage from buildings in the area, and they raided the offices of Wafa, the Palestinian news agency. Meanwhile, a Palestinian child was killed in an earlier shooting, and a pregnant woman was gravely wounded. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Mueller investigation. President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, was sentenced this afternoon to 36 months in a federal prison. He had earlier pleaded guilty to a number of felonies, what the judge called a smorgasbord of fraud. He apparently only partially cooperated with Mueller's investigation, and prosecutors told the judge that Cohen had been truthful. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I'm reminded of something that my attorneys used to complain about all the time, and that is what's called prosecutorial discretion. So Michael Cohen is the sacrificial lamb, it seems. He's going to go to most likely a minimum security work camp for 3 years, and with good time, he'll probably be out in a little over two. But there are so many other people who have been implicated in crimes, either directly related to the Mueller investigation or tangentially, people like Tony Podesta, for example, who haven't been charged with a crime. Why is that?
Well, the system gives a great deal of latitude to prosecutors, and it also invests them with a huge political role, a far too great a political role. So essentially, Mueller is sort of like bearing the burden of going after Trump, of bringing Trump down, which is his obvious mission. Congress won't do it. Congress can't do it. The people can't do it because even though they voted against Trump, the Constitution put him in the White House regardless. So it's all up to Mueller. And so Mueller is given great discretion and great responsibility. And he's using it in order to zero in on his assigned target.
I'm wondering, too, if we're not going to see prosecutions of high-level Democrats. I'm thinking also of Greg Craig. He's one of the most important attorneys in Washington. He is a close friend to the likes of John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. He's been implicated in some illegal lobbying activities, and certainly the Washington Post has mentioned it, but it doesn't look like any charges are forthcoming.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, prosecutorial excess is very dangerous. And there are no checks and balances, no accountability. They operate in secret, and they're given carte blanche to bring people down. Now, I'd be very worried if I was a Democrat in 2020 about what a Republican establishment might try to do to me. If I was Bernie Sanders, I'd be very worried.
I have to wonder, Brian, if this is just going to be the norm now. I mean, have our politics become so ugly, so hideous, that we just plan out prosecuting one another from administration to administration?
Let's ask Daniel this question. It seems to me, Daniel, that while it seems astonishing, maybe it's not astonishing. Maybe maybe there's an element of business as usual here where prosecutors and the FBI and police agencies, they kind of know a lot about people who are engaged in white collar crime. It's kind of on the shelf. And then they decide at a certain moment, hey, okay, for political reasons, we're going to snap on this person. And of course, they have the evidence. They've had it for a long time. They haven't done anything with it because they have prosecutorial discretion. Maybe it's the norm. I don't know. Seems like it.
I think it is. I think it's politics by other means. And as gridlock, worsens on Capitol Hill, as all the governing institutions become increasingly deadlocked and frozen, then the baton passes to the prosecutors to accomplish certain ends. So therefore, we have government via prosecution, and it's increasingly vicious. At least with an increasingly vicious atmosphere in Washington, and it's government by scandal, government by gotcha, government by prosecution. And I think it's very dangerous.
Tony Podesta is the brother of John Podesta. They both started what's called the Podesta Group here in Washington, D.C. John Podesta is no longer with the Podesta Group, but John Podesta was the individual whose emails were hacked because he was the campaign chairperson of Hillary Clinton's 2016 election campaign. The investigation referred to Justice Department prosecutors by special counsel Robert Mueller earlier in 2018, referred to possible criminal activity by the Clinton-linked Washington insider Tony Podesta and, of course, former Obama White House counsel Greg Craig. The inquiry centers not only on Craig and Podesta, but also on a former GOP congressman. And Daniel Lazar, if I'm not mistaken, what this goes to, of course, we don't have the insider information yet. There hasn't been an indictment. Maybe there will be an indictment of Podesta. But the Podesta Group was also doing work in Ukraine, like Paul Manafort was. Manafort was convicted of financial crimes, hiding his assets, laundering money, not paying taxes. That was money derived from his time in Ukraine working on behalf of the Yanukovych government that was overthrown in a coup in February 2014. The reports are that Podesta was also working perhaps as a subcontractor with Manafort in Ukraine and doing the similar lobbying, because guess what? A lot of internationally oriented lobbying firms work for a lot of foreign governments. I mean, that's just what they do. The Podesta Group is now registered as a foreign agent for Saudi Arabia, for instance, and that was the case in the 2016 election campaign. Go ahead.
Well, I totally agree. It's fertile ground for any prosecutor, and therefore they have a free hand in deciding who to prosecute and who not to. And the political dangers are obvious. I mean, in a town, Washington, where everyone does this, where really the level of corruption is just astonishing, then prosecutors can freely choose who to prosecute, who to go after, and who not to. I think it's very dangerous.
One thing that's also bubbled up is related to Michael Cohen. Is Cohen was charged partly with the attempts to silence Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels, two women who say that they had a sexual affair with or some sort of liaison with Donald Trump, and that Donald Trump was trying to keep them quiet, paid them money or paid the money to a publisher so that they could catch and kill the story. That's part of this story. Again, not about Russia collusion, not about Russia collusion. And a court just ruled, I believe yesterday, that Stormy Daniels has to pay $300,000 to Donald Trump.
Yeah, court costs and attorney's fees.
For bringing a frivolous lawsuit because she sued Trump over a tweet that he made regarding her allegations that she had been threatened in a parking lot, in a mall parking lot. Anyway, again, that was big news, big story. Again, not Russia, not about the Russian collusion. And that's the hideous part of this, is that people might not know that it's not really about the Russia probe, even though it's coming under the aegis of the Russia probe.
I mean, also, it's also not Paula Jones. I mean, what would Democrats be saying if a special prosecutor was going after Bill and Hillary Clinton for some kind of similar activities with regard to the many, many allegations, sexual allegations concerning, Bill Clinton's days? So Democrats would be screaming, jumping up and down, charging, you know, political persecution, but they're utterly silent now when the same techniques are brought to bear on Trump. But as I said, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a very dangerous development. The whole thing is extremely worrisome from a Democratic, small d Democratic point of view.
I'm wondering, too, if this is just the beginning, that we should expect more of these tangential charges where people may or may not be able to provide the Mueller people with something against the president. We've got about 30 seconds left. Go right ahead.
It's very worrisome. I mean, like, now, of course, there's the guilt is widely spread in Washington. You know, so in 2020, if Bernie Sanders, you know, runs for president, we can expect some of the same techniques to be brought to bear against him. And his, and as we know, his wife was involved in some kind of mini, you know, real estate imbroglio in Vermont. And so, you know, so undoubtedly there's, you know, there's fertile soil for any prosecutor to go digging through. And maybe somehow they'll come up with something against against Sanders. But it's not going to stop here. Everyone will be affected by this prosecutorial excess.
So far, John, seven people have pled guilty. Manafort was the only one who's been convicted at a trial. Again, white-collar crime, fraud, corruption. Again, so far, nothing about Russian collusion.
Nothing at all about Russian collusion. We're going to see a lot of very short prison sentences in very easy minimum security prisons. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Meng Wanzhou was arrested on December 1st at the request of the United States because her company allegedly is doing business with Iran, which is subject to U.S. sanctions. But she has now been released on bail by order of a judge in Canada. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Hi there.
Jude, this whole Huawei thing to me is very frustrating, and it's because nothing is as it seems. We have a situation where Huawei is legally doing business in Iran, but that violates a domestic U.S. law. So she travels to Canada. She's arrested at the request of the United States in Canada on December the 1st. She's held all this time. 3 days of hearings finally have resulted in bail. And in the meantime, now the Chinese government has arrested the Canadian CEO, who's also a former diplomat, the CEO of the International Crisis Group. Now the conventional wisdom is there's going to have to be some sort of a swap. What exactly are we looking at here? How long is this thing going to drag out?
Well, I mean, obviously, China is quite concerned to deal with this with Canada, but everybody knows that it's really not Canada. This is the United States that has initiated this. So that's the first point. And I think China is being quite careful, actually, because given that tensions with the United States are so high anyway over the tariffs, etc., and there was this glimmer of an opening at the G20 to get some negotiations on that, I think they don't want to escalate this. The interesting question was it deliberately done to derail the progress at the G20? Is one side of the administration working against another side of the administration? But leaving all that aside, it's absolutely scandalous what's been done. It's unbelievable to arrest an individual because you claim that their company has breached a sanction. That's completely unprecedented.
It is unprecedented, frankly, and I'm not sure what the United States gets out of this.
Well, it's just hostage taking. The United States bullying Canada to do something that's against Canada's interests. And Canada, the Justin Trudeau government, is so feeble, apparently, so unable to even defend Canadian sovereignty and Canadian national interests that they capitulate. They allow this executive, this woman from China, when she lands in Vancouver and while she's transferring planes to be arrested and then held basically for 9 days or more and finally given bail of $10 million, which, and she has to be monitored with an electronic bracelet. She has a curfew. At least she's out of jail, which, of course, for her is a major, major relief. You can't get more provocative than this. Now, Donald Trump says, and this is going back to Jude Woodward's point, Donald Trump said that when he met with Xi Jinping on December 1st in Buenos Aires on the sidelines of the G20, and they came out and said, we had a wonderful meeting and there's going to be a truce in the 90-day truce in the trade war. Donald Trump says he did not know that she had been arrested that day. But John Bolton, his national security advisor, says he did know. So Bolton went into the meeting with Trump and Xi Jinping, allowed Trump to come out and make all of these spectacular statements about how good everything was going to be, knowing that, of course, the arrest of this high-level executive in Vancouver would have the opposite impact. There's no doubt about this. Go ahead, Jude.
Yeah, it's unbelievable that he could sit through this meeting and not inform his counterparts. But the whole way China was dealt with over this is incredible, because apparently Canada didn't even formally inform China that they had made this arrest of Meng Wanzhou, that they found out through other channels. And it was the Chinese government that had to approach the Canadian government saying, is this true that you've arrested her? So the whole way that China has been dealt with on this is absolutely incredible. But it is politically unbelievable that Bolton could sit through that meeting and not say a word about it.
Yeah, so we now have the arrest of a Canadian executive by China. I'm looking at the Global Times, the pro-Chinese government newspaper, privately owned. Here's a couple of the headlines. Canadian tourism facing drop with Chinese visitors put off by arrest of Huawei executive. Of course, people are going to feel that way in China.
And there are a lot of Chinese visitors to Canada.
Yeah, a lot, and a lot to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the issue really is, what will Canada and the Canadian government do? And what will the Canadian people do about a government that seems to act as a supplicant to Donald Trump? I mean, that's pretty humiliating.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the internal Canadian issue. But globally, I mean, the issue is the US going to be able to establish a new norm where, if it considers that a foreign company has breached US sanctions, and these are not UN sanctions, these are US sanctions. They've not been agreed by the UN. So even if Huawei, which is denied, has breached the US sanctions, is it acceptable that the US arrests or organizes the arrest of individual executives of such a company? I mean, JP Morgan Chase was found in breach of the US sanctions on Cuba, but we didn't see their key executives being put in leg irons. It's absolutely incredible way to behave.
Yeah, and of course, here, just for our audience to understand, the Chinese could arrest an American executive, but they've chosen a Canadian executive because they don't want to have a direct confrontation with the Trump administration, who would then be compelled by the anti-China hawks to carry out additional retaliation. Jude Woodward is our guest. John Kiriakou, you know, it's not just the arrest of this Huawei executive in Canada.
Right.
Trump came out, declared a truce. The stock market went through the roof. Everybody seemed to be happy. But in this 90-day so-called truce, even now there are reports that the United States is prepared to impose new sanctions and new economic penalties on China or Chinese leadership.
Yes, the Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration is preparing to declassify intelligence, not further identified, pointing to the Chinese government and a hack that occurred in 2014. The Washington Post says that the administration is planning to declassify that intelligence and then to impose sanctions on the people who are believed to be responsible for the hacks.
That doesn't sound like a 90-day truce.
Indeed, it doesn't. And we should see this in the coming days.
Go ahead, June.
Well, yeah, I mean, this so-called 90-day truce is obviously very tense, as we've already seen over Wanzhou. But we'll have to see what happens on this. The US has taken sanctions against individuals that they claim were involved in hacks, etc., before. So in a certain sense, this is not new, but we have to see what exactly these sanctions are. But clearly, the situation is extremely tense, and the US is pursuing a course in relation to China of just making up new international law without it going through any international bodies, and just setting new precedents in the way that governments can behave. It's to be hoped that not everybody decides to adopt the same methods.
Right. What we're witnessing, I think, John, is a form, not the exact traditional form, but a form of what's called extraterritoriality by the United States.
Yes, indeed.
You know, which is part of the colonial legacy, whereby the imperial colonizing powers say, look, your laws can't apply to us. We have our own laws, and those laws are universal. They apply to you, but you can't apply your laws to us. I mean,
we see it with the International Court of Justice, with other international bodies. If we don't like it, we just ignore it.
Can you imagine China now arresting American or Canadian executives because they did something that violated China's laws, and they arrested them through a third country on a third country's territory, and then held them essentially incommunicado? Can you imagine what the reaction would be? We'd be up close to World War III.
Yeah, we would. It would be kidnapping, plain and simple.
1 minute left. Go ahead, Jude.
Yeah, well, that's I think the extraterritorial aspect is exactly the point. I mean, the U.S. claims it can order other countries to stop trading with third parties, whether it's Cuba or Iran. But can you imagine the U.S. tolerating China or any other country telling it which countries American companies were allowed to trade with? It's absolutely inconceivable that the US would permit that. And this is all being done outside any agreement of the UN or any international body, because the only country that is in proposes sanctions on Iran now is the US. The UN Security Council has called for the dropping of sanctions on Iran. So the US under Trump is absolutely tearing up international law. And this is not just dangerous to China, it's dangerous to the whole of world peace.
Yes, John, I think we're going to have to keep following this story. Again, the executive from Huawei company who's been now granted bail. But guess what? America hasn't even filed an extradition claim. This is completely in the sovereign control of the Canadian government. It's the U.S. driving it, but the Canadian government could take action to make sure that she is set free. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're going to keep following it.
We're out of time, so we'll leave it there. We were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Lawmakers from Britain's Conservative Party called for a no-confidence vote today in a bid to oust Prime Minister Theresa May because of the Brexit deal she negotiated with the European Union. However, as of the time of this recording, which is about 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, a majority of Tory party members have said that they would support May. That's enough for her to win. But the future of her government is still in doubt. We're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Walter, wow, there have been a lot of developments today. Theresa May apparently promised her backbenchers that if they were to vote in favor of her today, she would not run for re-election as the head of the party.
In 2022.
In 2022, correct. And according to the British press, it looks like she has enough votes to win this thing tonight. So she'll remain prime minister at least for a while. That's all fine and good. But what does it do about Brexit?
Yeah, well, it seems likely that she'll win. I mean, the vote is, you know, like you mentioned, we don't know for sure the results yet. But yeah, this pledge that she would not lead the party into the 2022 general election appears to have sealed the deal for her. The way that she phrased the pledge, it's not my intention to lead the party into the 2022 general election. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's sort of like one of the most hardline, you know, pro-Brexit members of Parliament, you know, he said, oh, well, that's, you know, that leaves too much ambiguity. You know, it could be, you know, not your intention, but then, you know, some emergency happens or whatever. But I think that this does momentarily strengthen Theresa May's ability to push through the Brexit deal. It seems that the negotiations, you know, have been going on for almost 2 years now. The deal that's been hammered out, I can't imagine there being substantial changes made to it, you know, this late in the game. And there's been no indication that despite all these talks that anything substantive will be made. Maybe there could be cosmetic changes to sort of give politicians an out, an excuse to support it. But, you know, the deal determining or laying out the terms of the separation of the UK from the European Union seems to be set, and now she has to go ahead and try to convince a majority of Parliament, which is different than what she's trying to do today, which is just convince a majority of Conservative Party MPs, but a majority in the House of Commons to vote in favor of it, to approve it.
Most Americans don't know how the U.S. government works, so fewer of them will know how the British government works.
Right.
I'm just guessing. If she wins, as we now seem to, well, we're not making predictions because we stopped doing that on the November election in 2016. If she wins, she remains as party leader and prime minister, and a confidence vote cannot be triggered via the same mechanism for a year. That gives Theresa May 1 year. In some ways, this will strengthen her position, as you said, Walter. A couple of days ago, people were expecting Theresa May to be gone, not in months, not even in weeks, but perhaps in days.
Well, there are still a couple of things that could happen that could bring her down. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think she's probably in better shape today than she has been in many weeks. But if there are members of the Conservative Party who are angry enough at the way this has played out that they resign, and they can either resign from the party and remain in parliament as independents or resign from parliament, it could be enough to bring down her government. Similarly, if the Democratic Unionist Party decides that they don't like it and they decide that while they can remain in parliament, they don't have to remain as a part of the government, that would also bring her down.
And they're the Northern Ireland Protestant reactionary.
That's right.
Dinosaur party.
That's right. But there are just enough of them in parliament to give her a working majority.
10, yeah. Yeah, and just enough.
Yeah, that's right. So, okay, so just to back up a little bit, there's two different majorities that we're talking about here. There's, does Theresa May have the confidence of the Conservative Party to be their leader? And so that's what's being tested today. Are there a majority of Conservative Party MPs who will vote in favor of her being their leader? And therefore, if you're the leader of the majority party, you're the largest party that can prove a majority in parliament, you are the prime minister under the British system of government. But there's another type of no confidence vote that Theresa May could face, which is the, you know, confidence in parliament. So that means that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn or, you know, one of the other, you know, opposition members of parliament could introduce a resolution saying, hey, Theresa May, you don't have the support of the majority of parliament. You have to prove it in this vote. And so if the Democratic Unionist Party, the, you know, the hardline Irish right wing, you know, former paramilitary organization withdraws their support from the government, then the Conservative Party does not have a majority in parliament. And furthermore, if, you know, some of the more hard right members of her own party decide to vote against her in a vote of no confidence, then the government falls as well.
Okay, so then if the government falls, just stay with this, because again, I want people here in the United States to understand it. If it, quote, falls, what happens?
Then there's an election. And so a very possible outcome of that scenario is that Jeremy Corbyn becomes the prime minister of the UK. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls now, it's pretty much neck and neck between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, the two major parties in British politics. But, you know, if you go into an election where the incumbent government loses a vote of no confidence, when, you know, the Brexit deal, if there's a vote of no confidence, right, that means that the Brexit deal probably didn't go well. You know, the clearly the edge in that type of situation would go to the Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn, who's, you know, it's so shocking. Like, if, like, for people who, you know, have watched British politics develop over the years, the idea that Jeremy Corbyn, who's sort of like maybe the most left-wing member of the Parliamentary Labour Party, or certainly one of a handful of the most left-wing people, to become, I mean, the fact that he became the leader of the Labour Party was a tremendous shock in the first place. The fact that he survived so long when, you know, he's had to face the opposition of so many centrist members of his own party.
They changed the rules and 500,000 young people were able to come into the party. That's why Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of Labour.
Right, because the leader of the Labour Party is, it's sort of like an election, in a primary election in the United States. It's actually, you know, like popularly elected and not just by, you know, a party leadership body. And so Jeremy Corbyn's position there is secure, right, because he's tremendously popular, even though his own members of parliament, or at least a lot of them, don't actually support him. And then, you know, he could become the prime minister of the country, and that's an unthinkable thing for a lot of these people who also might have a political problem with Theresa May.
Okay, let's say Theresa May survives this no confidence vote within her own party. Then next step is the parliament has to decide on the Brexit deal. If the Democratic Union Party, the DUP, what I call the dinosaur party, if they're going to vote against it, they're going to vote against it because the Brexit deal also includes a soft border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. That's a complicated story. We've covered it in the past. We'll cover it more in the future. Okay, Theresa May loses that group. If all of Labour voted then against the Brexit agreement fails, correct?
Yeah, along with a couple smaller anti-Brexit parties like the Scottish National Party and the Liberal Democrats.
And the question then would be a new election and Jeremy Corbyn would win.
He would like to
win. I'm asking you, Walter, I'm asking you your opinion. Will parts of the Labour Party who are pro-Tony Blair, the Clintonite wing of the Labour Party, the neocon wing of the Labour Party, would they block with Theresa May on this Brexit agreement because they prefer that than having an election where somebody from their own party, someone named Jeremy Corbyn, the left wing, would actually win?
I think there is definitely a possibility of that. There's a good possibility of it. But I think the way that they would package or present their decision to the public is as though they had to make this sort of noble sacrifice to prevent a no-deal Brexit, which would be the most catastrophic thing that could possibly happen, the UK leaving the European Union without a deal on how to sort of cleanly separate in terms of economic policy and legal integration.
That's how they would explain it, that it was for the good of the country.
Yeah.
But what I want you to, you know, sort of zero in on is, however they explain it, the real goal would be to stop Jeremy Corbyn. It seems to me that parts of the establishment in Britain, whether they're conservative, whether they're liberal, whether they're Labour, they don't want Jeremy Corbyn, who, guess what, is an anti-imperialist political figure and has been his whole life, to become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, the amount of political variance inside the Labour Party, I think, it's much, much wider than there would be inside, say, the Democratic Party, where, you know, of course, there's sort of like the pro-Clinton, you know, quote-unquote, third-way Democrats, and then there are people like Bernie Sanders. But the chasm in the Labour Party is much, much wider. I mean, the Labour Party, you know, I mean, I think they only got rid of this in like the 1990s or 2000s, you know, a clause saying, we are for the socialization of the means of production. You know what I mean? Like it's really, truly much faster on foreign policy as well, where Jeremy Corbyn's in the anti-imperialist camp.
Okay, thank you, Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. He joined us here in the studio. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Turkish President Erdogan said today that his country would begin a new military offensive within days in northern Syria, quote, to clear the area of Kurdish rebels on both sides of the Euphrates River, unquote. Erdogan added that Turkey would specifically not target Americans in the area, but the move will almost certainly raise tensions with the United States. We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former British ambassador to Syria. Ambassador, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Should we be surprised, Ambassador, that President Erdogan has gone public with this announcement already?
Well, no, because it's been in the offing ever since General Mattis announced a few weeks ago that the U.S. was going ahead with setting up observation posts over Turkish objections. This was asking for trouble, and Erdogan is now giving it.
Yeah. Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. Here's what Erdogan said about those Pentagon observation posts. Again, illegally established in Syria
Syrian
along the
territory.
Syrian, yeah, it's Syrian territory. Quote, we know that the aim of the radar and observation posts set up by the United States east of the Euphrates is not to protect our country from terrorists, but to protect the terrorists from Turkey. That's Erdogan. I mean, Ambassador Ford, Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. NATO is a U.S.-led military alliance. U.S. troops are illegally occupying northern Syria, again, east of the Euphrates, working with the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, largely Kurdish units. Might there be a clash between the United States and Turkey?
I'd be very surprised if there was a military clash. I'm sure the Turks will be very careful not to cause any skirmishes with U.S. forces, and the same is true the other way around. So I don't seriously expect that there to be direct conflict, but it's bad enough that the Turks are very likely just to walk in, defy the U.S., and simply swamp the small U.S. observation forces on the ground. at the very least, it's going to be humiliating to the United States.
Ambassador, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff and the former director of policy planning at the State Department, said over the weekend that that the U.S. has a permanent military presence now in Syria. This is something that has not been mentioned even to the American people, that troop strength is something like 12,000. And this permanent base that exists in eastern Syria, rather, even has fast food outlets, indicating that it's permanent. This is not a temporary thing. How does this affect the situation along the border? You're going to have American troops, if not right there, nearby, permanently or semi-permanently, and the Turks wanting to cross the border to hit as many Kurds as they can, with the Kurds, of course, being allies of the United States.
Well, there's not just one base. In fact, there are no fewer than 12 U.S. bases and two airfields in northeastern Syria, all illegal, all illegal. Turkey's own presence, by the way, in Syria is also, of course, illegal. Nobody has consulted the legitimate Syrian government in any of this. But it's a fact that the U.S. has put down a couple of Bagram-style bases in this area, all primarily with the ostensible, superficial excuse of fighting ISIS, but the real purpose to deny territory to Assad, to a legitimate government. This is what it's all about. You know, we have to ask, well, why is the U.S. risking confrontation with Turkey? What major U.S. interest is at stake here? Going to almost to war with an important NATO ally, there must be some very important U.S. interest. But on examination, we find that there is no U.S. interest here. There is just a selfish desire to deny territory to Assad, who represents no strategic threat to the United States whatever.
So there's that issue. But I wonder if there's something else, too, because if the U.S. has 12 military bases, and if Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, is correct in terms of the numbers of American personnel, military personnel, they're greater than that which we've been told, at least the government telling people in America through the media or through government announcements. The selfish desire, that makes perfect sense to me. They want to have a selfish desire to deny the Syrian government of control over Syrian territory because maybe America's frustrated that they didn't succeed when they said, Assad must go, and he didn't go. In fact, he prevailed with the assistance of Russia and Iran and Hezbollah forces from Lebanon. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's like hubris and anger and frustration and pride. But I just wondered, Ambassador Ford, is there another geostrategic or military perspective that might also benefit from having U.S. military bases in northern Syria?
Well, vis-a-vis Iran, an argument can be made, and the U.S. administration is not slow making this argument, that by camping on Syrian territory, the U.S. is putting pressure on Iran to remove itself. Now, this logic, if you can call it that, is stupid because there is no way the Iranians are going to leave Assad in the lurch while there is a single set of U.S. military boots on the ground. It would make more sense to remove the U.S. troops, and then Iran would have far less pretext to hang around in Syria. But this is what passes for the thinking of these geniuses who make up U.S. policy.
Well, see, that's it right there. Nobody is coming up with U.S. policy. It's this slipshod, slapdash patchwork of policies where the State Department and the Defense Department, frankly, have more than 50% of their assistant secretary positions remaining vacant. You have people constantly coming and going, and you have a White House that is not leading in terms of policy formulation. And so when that happens, you end up with a situation like this, where we really don't know what the U.S. policy is, other than to occupy this territory.
And also, Ambassador Ford, the U.S. policy has, since World War II, since the time that the United States emerged as, you know, the real global power, sort of replace the British Empire as the dominant power in the West. The U.S. didn't acquire, not mainly colonies, but it did set up military bases and military installations as the method, the preferred method of deploying American power to demonstrate American power to impact local, both regions and countries around the world. Is that, can we put this, these military bases in Syria in that context as well?
Yes, I think that that's very an enlightened way to see it. The U.S. has about 800 military bases around the world, about 800. I think Russia maybe has 12, just to put things in perspective. But so these Syrian bases, I believe there are 12, two airstrips, are part of that bigger picture of imperial overreach and in imperial mission creep.
Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. Ambassador Ford, right now, Turkey's economy is tanking. How much do you think, in addition to, of course, Turkey wanting to assert its interests in Syria, as opposed to what the U.S. policy is in terms of favoring the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds, is Erdogan also trying to just kind of change the subject because of the economic woes of people in Turkey? Do you see that as part of this?
Possibly. And there are, I think, local elections coming up in Turkey in March. Not too much of a stretch to believe that this is part of Erdogan's calculation. However, he's incurring an economic cost. As you mentioned, the economy is tanking, and the risk of clashes with the U.S. has caused massive falls on the Turkish stock exchange. So it's not without risk for him. So I think he's doing it because he really believes it that he's been this has been one constant with Erdogan, the priority given to keeping an autonomous Kurdish entity far away from the Turkish border and preventing the emergence of such an entity to the full extent possible. This is what it's about. It's very basic, not tactical.
Interesting. You know, John, we really, really benefit from the analysis provided by Peter Ford, Ambassador Ford, former UK ambassador to Syria, because frankly, there's no analysis like his analysis, because it comes from a position of knowledge and oversight and context. There's nothing like this in Western corporate-owned media, at least in the United States. Maybe, Ambassador Ford, are you on BBC a lot?
I wish I was. No, I'm kept at arm's length generally, because my views are unpalatable. I call it like I see it. I'm not. Most people are guilty of wishful thinking. Their analysis is warped by the fact that they take their wishes for reality. That's where I differ.
Well, we'll leave it there. That was the voice of Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former British ambassador to Syria. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israeli soldiers entered Ramallah yesterday with low-level clashes breaking out only yards from the home of Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The soldiers seized security footage from buildings in the area, and they then raided the offices of Wafa, the Palestinian news agency. Meanwhile, a Palestinian child was killed in an earlier shooting, and a pregnant woman was gravely wounded. We're joined from Washington by Jonathan Kutab. He's an international human rights attorney. And we're also joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Jonathan, let's start with you. These clashes seem to happen all the time, to the point where, in many cases, they're not even newsworthy. But this one is different. This one is a raid on the Palestinian press agency. Why in the world would the Israelis do something like that?
Well, the Israelis have a very curious relationship with the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas and their news agency, obviously, Wafa, play a very useful but curious role as far as Israel is concerned. They keep the lid on, they provide security coordination, They lighten the burden and the task of ruling the Palestinian people. They provide the appearance and the fiction that the two-state solution is still possible and that we're just working out the details with the Palestinian Authority. On the other hand, they are so totally and completely in control that they overstep their boundaries all the time. They overreach. They try to do a little bit more, a little bit more. They demand that the Palestinian Authority do more to the point where it loses its very essence and any kind of support or credibility it has with its own people. So it is not unusual that every once in a while they would have incursion where they would enter into the area that is supposedly under the control of the Palestinian Authority, and they directly do what they want to do rather than wait and demand that the Palestinian Authority do it for them.
Dan Cohen, that's an important point. It seems that the Israelis ought to know, or ought to appreciate anyway, the fact that anytime something like this happens, they weaken the Palestinian Authority. And it's the Palestinian Authority that they're supposed to be working with in order to keep more militant groups, Hamas comes immediately to mind, at bay. So why would the Israelis violate that or cross that line? It seems like a red line to me, for something as minor as a routine clash like this.
Well, I think the Israelis are so drunk with impunity that they understand that the rules don't really apply to them. Even though, you know, the Palestinian Authority is really the greatest asset to the occupation. It really has Israel has managed to outsource the daily work of the occupation, much of it at least, to the Palestinian Authority. But at the same time, you know, the Israeli public sees that the Palestinian Authority is ultimately incapable of completely 100% subduing the Palestinian population. So the Israelis essentially use the Palestinian Authority to do its bidding, but at the same time kind of as a whipping boy for its failures and inability to, you know, do what it promises the Israeli public, which is, you know, provide 100% total security. But, you know, ultimately when it comes down to it, both the Palestinian Authority and Israel know that they are linked at the hip. If the Palestinian Authority were ultimately not useful to Israel, it wouldn't exist. And, you know, but without it, Israel would actually have to administer its own occupation.
Brian, there's a very popular television series on Netflix. It's an Israeli series called Fauda, and it's in both Hebrew and Arabic, very highly regarded, nominated for many awards. And it goes very much into this relationship between the Israeli authorities and the Palestinian authorities. As Dan says, they're joined at the hip, and that's true. They really are joined at the hip. The Israelis could not maintain peace in the occupied territories without the Palestinian Authority working with them. So to jeopardize that relationship seems to me to be so counterproductive, so counterintuitive, that I'm just simply at a loss to understand what the Israelis get out of something like today's actions.
Well, think about it this way. Every colonial power has had to rely on some indigenous force to maintain colonial rule. It can't be simply the colonizer.
Good point.
And there's sometimes friction between the colonizing force and the those who function as their quislings, in essence.
Yes.
Because ultimately the quisling, unlike the colonial power, also has to answer to or be involved in, engaged in, with the people that they're being used to suppress. So there's all kinds of times throughout history where contradictions develop, because it's not really a partnership between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli Authority. It's not a partnership. A partnership implies a certain equality,
mm-hmm.
a certain symmetry. This is the Palestinian Authority is supposed to function and is allowed to function and paid to function as an extension of Israeli power. But at any time, the Israelis can sort of tell everybody who's boss. And maybe that's what's going on. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think that that is accurate. I think that the significant thing is the hubris of power. Somehow the Israelis cannot avoid overreaching. It's partly the nature of a very powerful regime like that, that it will always exceed and its own interests by trying to overreach. It pains me to talk about the Palestinian Authority in those terms, because there are some very good and decent people working within the Palestinian Authority who believed at one point that it was possible for that authority to develop into a Palestinian state and to become a genuine partner to peacemaking. But I think that it has been really abused by the Israeli overreaching to the point where it no longer really can play that function anymore and no longer can be looked upon by its own people as a legitimate, shall we say, state in the making, which was what it was originally intended to be.
Dan, Brian made a point to me off the air that I think is very important, and I'd like your comments too, because you've spent so much time in the region. You've worked with Israeli authorities because you needed various permissions to film your documentaries. Brian said something that has now stuck with me. It's that the Israelis have acted with impunity for so long. The Israelis have acted where there have been no consequences for so long. They know they can get away with actions like this, and they don't care that it weakens the Palestinian Authority. Do you think this is what it is, that it's this impunity that they've been operating with in the West Bank that's gotten them into this situation?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, ultimately, Israel knows it, the Palestinian Authority is useful, but it has total impunity. I mean, Israel has never had any real consequences. I mean, even from, you know, the president, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president who heads the PA, who has, you know, outlasted his term. I mean, he makes all kinds of threats to end, you know, collect with what they euphemistically call security coordination with Israel, which is really just collaboration. He makes threats to end this. He makes, you know, all kinds of threats that this is all going to end, that this, you know, golden age for Israel is going to end. But then he never follows through. And it's because his position is predicated on the existence of the Palestinian Authority. And so Israel knows it, that he won't actually do anything. And so it just acts with total impunity, whether that's from, the Palestinian Authority that, you know, suppresses Palestinian resistance, that or from, you know, the so-called international community, from the United States, from the European Union, who underwrite the entire Israeli, you know, colonization and occupation project. And so there's really no consequences for it. And we see, you know, I mean, and this is going back decades and decades, but never more so than under the Trump administration, which, I mean, just is giving Israel essentially everything it wants. So, I mean, Israel is basically like a petulant child that is able to just do anything within, you know, certain constraints in the region. But in terms of, you know, its relationship with the Palestinian Authority, it's anything goes.
We have 1 minute left, Jonathan Kutab. Here we had a 5-year-old boy died yesterday. His name is Ahmed Abu Abed, died in a hospital in Gaza. He was critically injured by Israeli gunfire on Friday at one of those protests that have been taking place on Friday. It's called the Great March of Return. It was launched on March 30th. The number of people killed by Israeli gunmen now, Palestinians who were in part of the demonstration, has reached 240. 25,000 others have been wounded. Go ahead, Jonathan. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I think this is a most interesting thing, because on the one hand, you have Palestinians turning massively to nonviolence as a form of resistance, while Israelis very coldly and deliberately impose an increasingly heavy price on the population, hoping that these protests will end. Netanyahu represents a view that if you are powerful, you can do what you want. Morality means nothing. We can even have peace with all the Arab countries. We don't have to worry about making peace with Israel. If we are strong, we can do what we want. Morality means nothing. And in the short term, it looks like he's succeeding, that Israel is getting away with it. But anybody with any kind of historical perspective, yeah, anybody who is willing to look beyond his nose realizes that this kind of attitude is counterproductive, that ultimately we don't know when, we don't know how, but ultimately we know apartheid will end, the wall will fall, communism will collapse, dictatorial regimes will implode.
We're going to have to leave it there, Jonathan. That was the voice of Jonathan Kutab. He joined us from Washington. He's an international human rights lawyer. And we were also joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker whose most recent film is called Killing Gaza. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.